This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. This recording by Carl Manchester, 2007. God and the State by Mikhail Bakunin. Chapter 3. Nevertheless, we must not rely too much on this. Though we may be well nigh certain that a savant would not dare to treat a man today as he treats a rabbit, it remains always to be feared that the savants as a body, if not interfered with, may submit living men to scientific experiments, undoubtedly less cruel, but none the less disagreeable to their victims. If they cannot perform experiments upon the bodies of individuals, they will ask nothing better than to perform them on the social body, and that is what must be absolutely prevented. In their existing organisation, monopolising science and remaining thus outside of social life, the savants form a separate caste, in many respects analogous to the priesthood. Scientific abstraction is their god. Living and real individuals are their victims, and they are the consecrated and licensed sacrifices. Science cannot go outside of the sphere of abstractions. In this respect, it is infinitely inferior to art, which, in its turn, is peculiarly concerned also with general types and general situations, but which incarnates them by an artifice of its own, in forms which, if they are not living in the sense of real life, nonetheless excite in our imagination the memory and sentiment of life. Art, in a certain sense, individualizes the types and situations which it conceives, by means of the individualities without flesh and bone, and consequently permanent and immortal, which it has the power to create. It recalls to our minds the living, real individualities which appear and disappear under our eyes. Art, then, is, as it were, the return of abstraction to life. Science, on the contrary, is the perpetual immolation of life, fugitive, temporary, but real, on the altar of eternal abstractions. Science is as incapable of grasping the individuality of a man as that of a rabbit, being equally indifferent to both. Not that it is ignorant of the principle of individuality, it conceives it perfectly as a principle, but not as a fact. It knows very well that all the animal species, including the human species, have no real existence outside of an indefinite number of individuals, born and dying to make room for new individuals, equally fugitive. It knows that in rising from the animal species to the superior species, the principle of individuality becomes more pronounced. The individuals appear freer and more complete. It knows that man, the last and most perfect animal of earth, presents the most complete and most remarkable individuality, because of his power to conceive, create, personify, as it were, in his social and private existence, the universal law. It knows, finally, when it is not vitiated by theological or metaphysical, political or judicial doctrinarism, or even by a narrow scientific pride, when it is not deaf to the instincts and spontaneous aspirations of life, it knows, and this is its last word, that respect for man is the supreme law of humanity, and that the great, the real object of history, its only legitimate object, is the humanization and emancipation, the real liberty, the prosperity and happiness of each individual living in society. For if we would not fall back into the liberticidal fiction of the public welfare represented by the state, a fiction always founded on the systematic sacrifice of the people, we must clearly recognize that collective liberty and prosperity exist only so far as they represent the sum of individual liberties and prosperities. Science knows all these things, but it does not and cannot go beyond them. Abstraction being its very nature, it can well enough conceive the principle of real and living individuality, but it can have no dealings with real and living individuals. It concerns itself with individuals in general, but not with Peter or James, not with such and such a one, who, so far as it is concerned, do not, cannot have any existence. Its individuals, I repeat, are only abstractions. Now, history is made not by abstract individuals, but by acting, living, and passing individuals. Abstractions advance only when borne forward by real men. For these beings made not in idea only, but in reality of flesh and blood, science has no heart. It considers them, at most, as material for intellectual and social development. What does it care for the particular conditions and chance fate of Peter or James? It would make itself ridiculous. It would abdicate. It would annihilate itself, if it wished to concern itself with them, otherwise than as examples in support of its eternal theories. And it would be ridiculous to wish it to do so, for its mission lies not there. It cannot grasp the concrete. It can move only in abstractions. Its mission is to busy itself with the situation and the general conditions of the existence and development, either of the human species in general, or of such a race, such a people, such a class or category of individuals. The general causes of their prosperity, their decline, and the best general methods of securing their progress in all ways. Provided it accomplishes this task broadly and rationally, it will do its whole duty, and it would be really unjust to expect more of it. But it would be equally ridiculous, it would be disastrous, to entrust it with a mission which it is incapable of fulfilling. Since its own nature forces it to ignore the existence of Peter and James, it must never be permitted, nor must anybody be permitted in its name, to govern Peter and James, for it were capable of treating them almost as it treats rabbits. Or rather, it would continue to ignore them, but its licensed representatives, men not at all abstract, but on the contrary in very active life and having very substantial interests, yielding to the pernicious influence which privilege inevitably exercises upon men, would finally fleece other men in the name of science, just as they have been fleeced hitherto by priests, politicians of all shades, and lawyers, in the name of God, of the state, of judicial right. What I preach, then, is, to a certain extent, the revolt of life against science, or rather against the government of science. Not to destroy science, that would be high treason to humanity, but to remand it to its place so that it can never leave it again. Until now, all human history has been only a perpetual and bloody immolation of millions of poor human beings in honour of some pitiless abstraction. God, country, power of state, national honour, historical rights, judicial rights, political liberty, public welfare. Such has been, up to today, the natural, spontaneous and inevitable movement of human societies. We cannot undo it. We must submit to it so far as the past is concerned, as we submit to all natural fatalities. We must believe that that was the only possible way to educate the human race, for we must not deceive ourselves. Even attributing the larger part to the Machiavellian wiles of the governing classes, we have to recognise that no minority would have been powerful enough to impose all these horrible sacrifices upon the masses if there had not been, in the masses themselves, a dizzy, spontaneous movement which pushed them on to continual self-sacrifice, now to one, now to another of these devouring abstractions the vampires of history ever nourished upon human blood. We readily understand that this is very gratifying to the theologians, politicians, and jurists. Priests of these abstractions, they live only by the continual immolation of the people. Nor is it more surprising that metaphysics too should give its consent. Its only mission is to justify and rationalise as far as possible the iniquitous and absurd. But that positive science itself should have shown the same tendencies is a fact which we must deplore while we establish it. That it has done so is due to two reasons. In the first place, because, constituted outside of life, it is represented by a privileged body, and in the second place, because thus far it has posited itself as an absolute and final object of all human development. By a judicious criticism, which it can and finally will be forced to pass upon itself, it would understand, on the contrary, that it is only a means for the realisation of a much higher object, that of the complete humanisation of the real situation of all the real individuals who are born, who live, and who die on earth. The immense advantage of positive science over theology, metaphysics, politics, and judicial right consists in this, that, in the place of the false and fatal abstractions set up by these doctrines, it posits true abstractions, which express the general nature and logic of things, their general relations and the general laws of their development. This separates it profoundly from all preceding doctrines, and will assure it forever a great position in society. It will constitute, in a certain sense, society's collective consciousness. but there is one aspect in which it resembles all these doctrines. Its only possible object, being abstractions, it is forced by its very nature to ignore real men, outside of whom the truest abstractions have no existence. To remedy this radical defect, positive science will have to proceed by a different method from that followed by the doctrines of the past. The latter have taken advantage of the ignorance of the masses to sacrifice them with delight to their abstractions, which, by the way, are always very lucrative to those who represent them in flesh and bone. Positive science, recognizing its absolute inability to conceive real individuals and interests itself in their lot, must definitely and absolutely renounce all claim to the government of societies. For if it should meddle therein, it would only sacrifice continually the living men whom it ignores to the abstractions which constitute the sole object of its legitimate preoccupations. The true science of history, for instance, does not yet exist. Scarcely do we begin today to catch a glimpse of its extremely complicated conditions. But suppose it were definitely developed, what could it give us? It would exhibit a faithful and rational picture of the natural development of the general conditions, material and ideal, economical, political and social, religious, philosophical, aesthetic and scientific, of the societies which have a history. But this universal picture of human civilizations, however detailed it might be, would never show anything beyond general and consequently abstract estimates. The milliards of individuals who have furnished the living and suffering materials of this history, at once triumphant and dismal, triumphant by its general results, dismal by the immense hecatomb of human victims crushed under its ear, those milliards of obscure individuals without whom none of the great abstract results of history would have been obtained, and who, bear in mind, have never benefited by any of these results, will find no place, not even the slightest, in our annals. They have lived and been sacrificed, crushed for the good of abstract humanity, that is all. Shall we blame the science of history? That would be unjust and ridiculous. Individuals cannot be grasped by thought, by reflection, or even by human speech, which is capable of expressing abstractions only. They cannot be grasped in the present day any more than in the past. Therefore, social science itself, the science of the future, will necessarily continue to ignore them. All that we have a right to demand of it is that it shall point us with faithful and sure hand to the general causes of individual suffering. Among these causes, it will not forget the immolation and subordination, still too frequent, alas, of living individuals to abstract generalities, at the same time showing us the general conditions necessary to the real emancipation of the individuals living in society. That is its mission. Those are its limits, beyond which the action of social science can only be impotent and fatal. Beyond those limits being the doctrinaire and governmental pretensions of its licensed representatives, its priests. It is time to have done with all popes and priests. We want them no longer, even if they call themselves social democrats. Once more, the sole mission of science is to light the road. Only life, delivered from all its governmental and doctrinaire barriers and given full liberty of action, can create. How to solve this antinomy? On the one hand, science is indispensable to the rational organisation of society. On the other, being incapable of interesting itself in that which is real and living, it must not interfere with the real or practical organisation of society. This contradiction can be solved only in one way, by the liquidation of science as a moral being existing outside the life of all, and represented by a body of breveted savants. It must spread among the masses. Science, being called upon to henceforth represent society's collective consciousness, must really become the property of everybody. Thereby, without losing anything of its universal character, of which it can never divest itself without ceasing to be science, and while continuing to concern itself exclusively with general causes, the conditions and fixed relations of individuals and things, it will become one, in fact, with the immediate and real life of all individuals. That will be a movement analogous to that which said to the Protestants at the beginning of the Reformation that there was no further need for priests for man, who would henceforth be his own priest, every man, thanks to the invisible intervention of the Lord Jesus Christ alone, having at last succeeded in swallowing his good God. But here the question is not of Jesus Christ, nor good God, nor of political liberty, nor of judicial right, things all theologically or metaphysically revealed, and all alike indigestible. The world of scientific abstractions is not revealed, it is inherent in the real world, of which it is only the general or abstract expression and representation. As long as it forms a separate region, specially represented by the savants as a body, this ideal world threatens to take the place of a good God to the real world, reserving for its licensed representatives the office of priests. That is the reason why it is necessary to dissolve the special social organization of the savants by general instruction, equal for all in all things, in order that their masses, ceasing to be flocks led and shorn by privileged priests, may take into their own hands the direction of their destinies. Footnote. Science, in becoming the patrimony of everybody, will wed itself in a certain sense to the immediate and real life of each. It will gain in utility and grace what it loses in pride, ambition, and doctrinaire pedantry. This, however, will not prevent men of genius, better organized for scientific speculation than the majority of their fellows, from devoting themselves exclusively to the cultivation of the sciences and rendering great services to humanity. Only, they will be ambitious for no other social influence than the natural influence exercised upon its surroundings by every superior intelligence, and for no other reward than the high delight which a noble mind always finds in the satisfaction of a noble passion. End footnote. But until the masses shall have reached this degree of instruction, will it be necessary to leave them to the government of scientific men? Certainly not. It would be better for them to dispense with science than allow themselves to be governed by savants. The first consequence of the government of these men would be to render science inaccessible to the people, and such a government would necessarily be aristocratic, because the existing scientific institutions are essentially aristocratic, an aristocracy of learning. From the practical point of view, the most implacable, and from the social point of view, the most haughty and insulting. Such would be the power established in the name of science. This regime would be capable of paralysing the life and movement of society. The savants, always presumptuous, ever self-sufficient and ever impotent, would desire to meddle with everything, and the sources of life would dry up under the breath of their abstractions. Once more, life, not science, creates life. The spontaneous action of the people themselves alone can create liberty. Undoubtedly, it would be a very fortunate thing if science could, from this day forth, illuminate the spontaneous march of the people towards their emancipation. But better an absence of light than a false and feeble light, kindled only to mislead those who follow it. After all, the people will not lack light. Not in vain have they traversed a long historic career, and paid for their errors by centuries of misery. The practical summary of their painful experiences constitutes a sort of traditional science, which in certain respects is worth as much as theoretical science. Last of all, a portion of the youth, those of the bourgeois students, who feel hatred enough for the falsehood, hypocrisy, injustice and cowardice of the bourgeoisie to find courage to turn their backs upon it, and passion enough to unreservedly embrace the just and human cause of the proletariat, those will be, as I have already said, fraternal instructors of the people. Thanks to them, there will be no occasion for the government of the savants. If the people should beware of the government of the savants, all the more should they provide against that of the inspired idealists. The more sincere these believers and poets of heaven, the more dangerous they become. The scientific abstraction, I have said, is a rational abstraction, true in its essence, necessary to life, of which it is the theoretical representation, or, if one prefers, the conscience. It may, it must be, absorbed and digested by life. The idealistic abstraction, God, is a corrosive poison which destroys and decomposes life, falsifies and kills it. The pride of the idealists, not being personal but divine, is invincible and inexorable. It may, it must, die. But it will never yield. And while it has a breath left, it will try to subject men to its God, just as the lieutenants of Prussia, these practical idealists of Germany, would like to see the people crushed under the spurred boot of their emperor. The faith is the same, the end but little different, and the result, as that of faith, is slavery. It is at the same time the triumph of the ugliest and most brutal materialism. There is no need to demonstrate this in the case of Germany. One would have to be blind to avoid seeing it at the present hour. But I think it is still necessary to demonstrate it in the case of divine idealism. Man, like all the rest of nature, is an entirely material being. The mind, the facility of thinking, of receiving and reflecting upon different external and internal sensations, of remembering them when they have passed, and reproducing them by the imagination, of comparing and distinguishing them, of abstracting determinations common to them, and thus creating general concepts, and finally of forming ideas by grouping and combining concepts according to different methods. Intelligence, in a word, sole creator of our whole ideal world, is a property of the animal body, and especially of the quite material organism of the brain. We know this certainly by the experience of all, which no fact has ever contradicted, and which any man can verify at any moment of his life. In all animals, without excepting the wholly inferior species, we find a certain degree of intelligence, and we see that, in the series of species, animal intelligence develops in proportion as the organization of species approaches that of man, but that in man alone it attains to that power of abstraction which properly constitutes thought. Universal experience, which is the sole origin, the source of all our knowledge, shows us, therefore, that all intelligence is always attached to some animal body, and that the intensity, the power of this animal function, depends on the relative perfection of the organism. Footnote. Universal experience, on which all science rests, must be clearly distinguished from universal faith, on which the idealists wish to support their beliefs. The first is a real authentication of facts. The second is only a supposition of facts which nobody has seen, and which consequently are at variance with the experience of everybody. End footnote. The latter of these results of universal experience is not applicable only to the different animal species. We establish it, likewise, in men, whose intellectual and moral power depends so clearly upon the greater or less perfection of their organism as a race, as a nation, as a class, and as individuals, that it is not necessary to insist upon this point. Footnote. The idealists, all those who believe in the immateriality and immortality of the human soul, must be excessively embarrassed by the difference in intelligence existing between races, peoples, and individuals. Unless we suppose that the various divine particles have been irregularly distributed, how is this difference to be explained? Unfortunately, there is a considerable number of men wholly stupid, foolish, even to idiocy. Could they have received in the distribution a particle at once divine and stupid? To escape this embarrassment, the idealists must necessarily suppose that all human souls are equal, but that the prisons in which they find themselves necessarily confined, human bodies, are unequal, some more capable than others of serving as an organ for the pure intellectuality of the soul. According to this, such a one might have very fine organs at his disposition, such another, very gross organs. But these are distinctions which idealism has not the power to use without falling into inconsistency and the grossest materialism. For in the presence of absolute immateriality of soul, all bodily differences disappear. All that is corporeal, material, necessarily appearing indifferent, equally and absolutely gross. The abyss which separates soul from body, absolute immateriality from absolute materiality, is infinite. Consequently, all differences, by the way inexplicable and logically impossible, which may exist on the other side of the abyss, in matter, should be to the soul null and void, and neither can nor should exercise any influence over it. In a word, the absolutely immaterial cannot be constrained, imprisoned, and much less expressed in any degree whatsoever by the absolutely material. Of all the gross and materialistic, using the word in a sense attached to it by the idealists, imaginations which were engendered by the primitive ignorance and stupidity of men, that of an immaterial soul imprisoned in a material body is certainly the grossest, the most stupid, and nothing better proves the omnipotence exercised by ancient prejudices, even over the best minds, than the deplorable sight of men endowed with lofty intelligence, still taking of it in our days. End footnote. On the other hand, it is certain that no man has ever seen or can see pure mind, detached from all material form, existing separately from any animal body whatsoever. But if no person has seen it, how is it that men have come to believe in its existence? The fact of this belief is certain, and if not universal, as all the idealists pretend, at least very general, and as such it is entirely worthy of our closest attention. For a general belief, however foolish it may be, exercises too potent a sway over the destiny of men to warrant us in ignoring it or putting it aside. The explanation of this belief, moreover, is rational enough. The example afforded us by children and young people, and even by many men long past the age of majority, shows us that man may use his mental faculties for a long time before accounting to himself for the way in which he uses them, before becoming clearly conscious of it. During this working of the mind unconscious of itself, during this action of innocent or believing intelligence, man, obsessed by the external world, pushed on by that internal goad called life and its manifold necessities, creates a quantity of imaginations, concepts and ideas, necessarily very imperfect at first, and conforming but slightly to the reality of the things and facts which they endeavour to express. Not having yet the consciousness of his own intelligent action, not knowing yet that he himself has produced and continues to produce these imaginations, these concepts, these ideas, ignoring their wholly subjective, that is, human, origin, he must naturally consider them as objective beings, as real beings, wholly independent of him, existing by themselves and in themselves. It was thus that primitive peoples, emerging slowly from their animal innocence, created their gods. Having created them, not suspecting that they themselves were the real creators, they worshipped them. Considering them as real beings, infinitely superior to themselves, they attributed omnipotence to them, and recognized themselves as their creatures, their slaves. As fast as human ideas develop, the gods, who, as I have already stated, were never anything more than a fantastic, ideal, poetical reverberation of an inverted image, become idealized also. At first gross fetishes, they gradually become pure spirits, existing outside of the visible world, and at last, in the course of a long historic evolution, are confounded in a single divine being, pure, eternal, absolute spirit, creator and master of the worlds. In every development, just or false, real or imaginary, collective or individual, it is always the first step, the first act, that is the most difficult. That step once taken, the rest follows naturally as a necessary consequence. The difficult step in the historical development of this terrible religious insanity which continues to obsess and crush us was to posit a divine world as such outside the world. This first act of madness, so natural from the physiological point of view and consequently necessary in the history of humanity, was not accomplished in a single stroke. I know not how many centuries were needed to develop this belief and make it a governing influence upon the mental customs of men, but once established, it became omnipotent, as each insane notion necessarily becomes when it takes possession of man's brain. Take a madman, whatever the object of his madness. You will find that obscure and fixed idea which obsesses him seems to him the most natural thing in the world, and that, on the contrary, the real things which contradict this idea seem to him ridiculous and odious follies. Well, religion is a collective insanity, the more powerful because it is traditional folly, and because its origin is lost in the most remote antiquity. As collective insanity, it has penetrated to the very depths of the public and private existence of the peoples. It is incarnate in society. It has become, so to speak, the collective soul and thought. Every man is enveloped in it from his birth. He sucks it in with his mother's milk, absorbs it with all that he touches, all that he sees. He is so exclusively fed upon it, so poisoned and penetrated by it, in all his being, that later, however powerful his natural mind, he has to make unheard-of efforts to deliver himself from it, and then never completely succeeds. We have one proof of this in our modern idealists, and another in our doctrinaire materialists, the German communists. They have found no way to shake off the religion of the state. The supernatural world, the divine world, once well established in the imagination of the peoples, the development of the various religious systems has followed its natural and logical course, conforming, moreover, in all things to the contemporary development of economical and political relations, of which it has been in all ages in the world of religious fancy, the faithful reproduction and divine consecration. Thus has the collective and historical insanity, which calls itself religion, been developed since fetishism, passing through all the stages from polytheism to Christian monotheism. The second step in the development of religious beliefs, undoubtedly the most difficult next to the establishment of a separate divine world, was precisely this transition from polytheism to monotheism, from the religious materialism of the pagans to the spiritualistic faith of the Christians. She pagan gods, and this was their principal characteristic, were first of all exclusively national gods. Very numerous, they necessarily retained a more or less material character, or rather, they were so numerous because they were material, diversity being one of the principal attributes of the real world. The pagan gods were not yet strictly the negation of real things, they were only a fantastic exaggeration of them. We have seen how much this transition cost the Jewish people, constituting, so to speak, its entire history. In vain did Moses and the prophets preach the one God. The people always relapsed into their primitive idolatry, into the ancient and comparatively much more natural and convenient faith in many good gods, more material, more human, and more palpable. Jehovah himself, their sole God, the God of Moses and the prophets, was still an extremely national God, who, to reward and punish his faithful followers, his chosen people, used material arguments, often stupid, always gross and cruel. It does not even appear that faith in his existence implied a negation of the existence of earlier gods. The Jewish God did not deny the existence of all these rivals. He simply did not want his people to worship them side by side with him, because before all, Jehovah was a very jealous God. His first commandment was this: I am the Lord God, and thou shalt have no other gods before me. Jehovah, then, was only a first draft, very material and very rough, of the supreme deity of modern idealism. Moreover, he was only a national god, like the Russian god worshipped by the German generals, subjects of the Tsar and patriots of the empire of all the Russias. Like the German god, whom the pietists and the German generals, subjects of William I at Berlin, will no doubt soon proclaim. The supreme being cannot be a national god. He must be the god of entire humanity. Nor can the supreme being be a material being. He must be the negation of all matter, pure spirit. Two things have proved necessary to the realization of the worship of the supreme being. One, a realization, such as it is, of humanity by the negation of nationalities and national forms of worship. Two, a development, already far advanced, of metaphysical ideas in order to spiritualize the gross Jehovah of the Jews. The first condition was fulfilled by the Romans, though in a very negative way, no doubt, by the conquest of most of the countries known to the ancients, and by the destruction of their national institutions. The gods of all the conquered nations, gathered in the pantheon, mutually cancelled each other. This was the first draft of humanity, very gross and quite negative. As for the second condition, the spiritualization of Jehovah, that was realized by the Greeks long before the conquest of their country by the Romans. They were the creators of metaphysics. Greece, in the cradle of her history, had already found from the Orient a divine world which had been definitely established in the traditional faith of her peoples. This world had been left and handed over to her by the Orient. In her instinctive period, prior to her political history, she had developed and prodigiously humanized this divine world through her poets, and when she actually began her history, she already had a religion ready-made, the most sympathetic and noble of all the religions which have existed, so far at least as a religion, that is, a lie, can be noble and sympathetic. Her great thinkers, and no nation has had greater than Greece, found the divine world established not only outside of themselves in the people, but also in themselves as a habit of feeling and thought, and naturally they took it as a point of departure. That they made no theology, that is, that they did not wait in vain to reconcile dawning reason with the absurdities of such a god, as did the scholastics of the Middle Ages, was already much in their favour. They left the gods out of their speculations, and attached themselves directly to the divine idea, one, invisible, omnipotent, eternal, and absolutely spiritualistic, but impersonal. As concerns spiritualism, then, the Greek metaphysicians, much more than the Jews, were the creators of the Christian God. The Jews only added to it the brutal personality of their Jehovah. That a sublime genius like the divine Plato could have been absolutely convinced of the reality of the divine idea shows us how contagious, how omnipotent is the tradition of the religious mania, even on the greatest minds. Besides, we should not be surprised at it, since even in our day, the greatest philosophical genius which has ever existed since Aristotle and Plato, Hegel, in spite even of Kant's criticism, imperfect and too metaphysical though it be, which had demolished the objectivity or reality of the divine ideas, tried to replace these divine ideas upon their transcendental or celestial throne. It is true that Hegel went about his work of restoration in so impolite a manner that he killed the good God for ever. He took away from these ideas their divine halo, by showing to whoever will read him that they were never anything more than a creation of the human mind, running through history in search of itself. To put an end to all religious insanities and the divine mirage, he left nothing lacking but the utterance of those grand words which were said after him, almost at the same time by two great minds who had never heard of each other. Ludwig Feuerbach, the disciple and demolisher of Hegel, in Germany, and Auguste Comte, the founder of positive philosophy, in France. These words were as follows. Quote, "Metaphysics are reduced to psychology," end quote. All the metaphysical systems have been nothing else than human psychology developing itself in history. Today it is no longer difficult to understand how the divine ideas were born, how they were created in succession by the abstractive faculty of man. Man made the gods. But in the time of Plato, this knowledge was impossible. The collective mind, and consequently the individual mind as well, even that of the greatest genius, was not ripe for that. Scarcely had it said with Socrates, "Know thyself." This self-knowledge existed only in a state of intuition. In fact, it amounted to nothing. Hence it was impossible for the human mind to suspect that it was itself the sole creator of the divine world. It found the divine world before it. It found it as history, as tradition, as a sentiment, as a habit of thought, and it necessarily made it the object of its loftiest speculations. Thus was born metaphysics, and thus were developed and perfected the divine ideas, the basis of spiritualism. It is true that after Plato there was a sort of inverse movement in the development of the mind. Aristotle, the true father of science and positive philosophy, did not deny the divine world, but concerned himself with it as little as possible. He was the first to study, like the analyst and experimenter that he was, logic, the laws of human thought, and at the same time the physical world, not in its ideal illusory essence, but in its real aspect. After him, the Greeks of Alexandria established the first school of the positive scientists. They were atheists, but their atheism left no mark on their contemporaries. science tended more and more to separate itself from life. After Plato, divine ideas were rejected in metaphysics themselves. This was done by the Epicureans and Skeptics, two sects who contributed much to the degradation of human aristocracy, but they had no effect upon the masses. Another school, infinitely more influential, was formed at Alexandria. This was the school of Neoplatonists. These, confounding in an impure mixture the monstrous imaginations of the Orient with the ideas of Plato, were the true originators, and later the elaborators, of the Christian dogmas. Thus the personal and gross egoism of Jehovah, the not less brutal and gross Roman conquest, and the metaphysical ideal speculation of the Greeks, materialized by contact with the Orient, were the three historical elements which made up the spiritualistic religion of the Christians. Before the altar of a unique and supreme God was raised on the ruins of the numerous altars of the pagan gods, the autonomy of the various nations composing the pagan or ancient world had to be destroyed first. This was very brutally done by the Romans, who, by conquering the greatest part of the globe known to the ancients, laid the first foundations, quite gross and negative ones, no doubt, of humanity. A god thus raised above the national differences, material and social, of all countries, and in a certain sense the direct negation of them, must necessarily be an immaterial and abstract being. But faith in the existence of such a being, so difficult a matter, could not spring into existence suddenly. Consequently, as I have demonstrated in the appendix, it went through a long course of preparation and development at the hands of Greek metaphysics, which were the first to establish in a philosophical manner the notion of the divine idea, a model eternally creative and always reproduced by the visible world. But the divinity conceived and created by Greek philosophy was an impersonal divinity. No logical and serious metaphysics being able to rise, or rather to descend, to the idea of a personal god, it became necessary, therefore, to imagine a god who was one and very personal at once. He was found in the very brutal, selfish, and cruel person of Jehovah, the national god of the Jews. But the Jews, in spite of that exclusive national spirit which distinguishes them even today, had become, in fact, long before the birth of Christ, the most international people of the world. Some of them carried away as captives, but many more even urged on by that mercantile passion which constitutes one of the principal traits of their character. They had spread through all countries, carrying everywhere the worship of their Jehovah, to whom they remained all the more faithful the more he abandoned them. In Alexandria, this terrible god of the Jews made the personal acquaintance of the metaphysical divinity of Plato, already much corrupted by Oriental contact, and corrupted her still more by his own. In spite of his national, jealous, and ferocious exclusivism, he could no longer resist the grace of this ideal and impersonal divinity of the Greeks. He married her, and from this marriage was born the spiritualistic, but not spirited, god of the Christians. The Neoplatonists of Alexandria are known to have been the principal creators of the Christian theology. Nevertheless, theology alone does not make a religion, any more than historical elements suffice to create history. By historical elements, I mean the general conditions of any real development whatsoever, for example, in this case, the conquest of the world by the Romans and the meeting of the god of the Jews with the ideal of divinity of the Greeks. To impregnate the historical elements, to cause them to run through a series of new historical transformations, a living, spontaneous fact was needed, without which they might have remained many centuries longer in the state of unproductive elements. This fact was not lacking in Christianity. It was the propagandism, martyrdom, and death of Jesus Christ. We know almost nothing of this great and saintly personage, all that the Gospels tell us being contradictory, and so fabulous that we can scarcely seize upon a few real and vital traits. But it is certain that he was the preacher of the poor, the friend and consoler of the wretched, of the ignorant, of the slaves, and of the women, and that by these last he was much loved. He promised eternal life to all who are oppressed, to all who suffer here below, and the number is immense. He was hanged, as a matter of course, by the representatives of the official morality and public order of that period. His disciples and the disciples of his disciples succeeded in spreading, thanks to the destruction of the national barriers by the Roman conquest, and propagated the gospel in all the countries known to the ancients. Everywhere they were received with open arms by the slaves and the women, the two most oppressed, most suffering, and naturally also the most ignorant classes of the ancient world. For even such few proselytes as they made in the privileged and learned world, they were indebted in great part to the influence of women. Their most extensive propagandism was directed almost exclusively among the people, unfortunate and degraded by slavery. This was the first awakening, the first intellectual revolt of the proletariat. The great honour of Christianity, its incontestable merit, and the whole secret of its unprecedented and yet thoroughly legitimate triumph lay in the fact that it appealed to that suffering and immense public to which the ancient world, a strict and cruel intellectual and political aristocracy, denied even the simplest rights of humanity. Otherwise, it never could have spread. The doctrine taught by the apostles of Christ, wholly consoling as it may have seemed to the unfortunate, was too revolting, too absurd from the standpoint of human reason, ever to have been accepted by enlightened men. According with what joy the Apostle Paul speaks of the scandale de la foi, the scandal of faith, and of the triumph of that divine folie, divine madness, rejected by the powerful and wise of the century, but all the more passionately accepted by the simple, the ignorant, and the weak-minded. Indeed, there must have been a very deep-seated dissatisfaction with life, a very intense thirst of heart, and an almost absolute poverty of thought, to secure the acceptance of the Christian absurdity, the most audacious and monstrous of all religious absurdities. This was not only the negation of all the political, social, and religious institutions of antiquity, it was the absolute overturn of common sense, of all human reason. The living being, the real world, were considered thereafter as nothing, whereas the product of man's abstractive faculty, the last and supreme abstraction in which this faculty, far beyond existing things, even beyond the most general determinations of the living being, the ideas of space and time, having nothing left to advance beyond, rests in contemplation of his emptiness and absolute immobility. That abstraction, that caput mortuum, absolutely void of all contents, the true nothing, God, is proclaimed the only real, eternal, all-powerful being. The real all is declared nothing, and the absolute nothing, the all. The shadow becomes the substance, and the substance vanishes like a shadow. Footnote. I am well aware that in the theological and metaphysical systems of the Orient, and especially in those of India, including Buddhism, we find the principle of the annihilation of the real world in favour of the ideal and of absolute abstraction. But it has not the added character of voluntary and deliberate negation which distinguishes Christianity, when those systems were conceived. The world of human thought, of will, and of liberty had not reached that stage of development which was afterwards seen in the Greek and Roman civilization. End footnote. All this was audacity and absurdity unspeakable, the true scandale de la foi, the triumph of credulous stupidity over the mind, for the masses, and, for a few, the triumphant irony of a mind wearied, corrupted, disillusioned, and disgusted in honest and serious search for truth. It was that necessity of shaking off thought and becoming brutally stupid so frequently felt by surfeited minds. End of chapter 3.